particularly those in poor urban neighborhoods. He graphically reports on the decaying infrastructure, the underspending and overcrowding, the lack of art and music teachers, librarians, doctors, many of the things that are taken for granted in better-off, whiter public schools. But the central theme of Kozol's book, the theme that seems to connect these other troubling factors, is race. Kozol argues that racial segregation in public schools is beyond critical, perhaps as bad as it was three decades ago, with some formerly integrated schools becoming resegregated. Jonathan Kozol is the author of many books about education, among them Amazing Grace and Savage Inequalities. He joins us now by phone from Massachusetts. Welcome to Counterspin, Jonathan Kozol.
Thanks for having me. And I might say quickly, it's not simply that segregation has returned with a vengeance to public education. It's worse than it's been at any time since 1968. I notice introducing me, you said perhaps worse. There's no question that it's worse. We now have fewer black kids going to integrated schools than at any time since the year that Dr. King was assassinated. And, you know, I've just visited 60 schools over the past 5 years in the inner city schools. It's not just that they're kind of segregated. They're absolutely segregated. I never see white children. I mean, if you took a photograph of the typical class that I visit in any of our major inner cities, that photo would look exactly like a photograph of a class of black kids in Mississippi 50 years ago. You know, in New York, to take a glaring example, because that's the most segregated state for public schools in America, in New York, 7 out of 8 black kids go to segregated schools. You know, the real heartbreaker for a guy like me who grew up in the age of Dr. King and who actually sat at his feet and remembers his words, is that when I visit any city I've never been to before, black folks, in a kind of bitter joke, always say to me, if you want to see a really segregated school while you're here, just ask for one that's named for Dr. King, because typically the worst, most segregated, most underfunded, overcrowded, and academically failing schools are named for Dr. King, or for Rosa Parks, or for Thurgood Marshall. I always wonder why we name these horrible schools for people that black folks love. I always think we ought to name them for people that they don't like.
Well, Jonathan, you mentioned in an interview in Salon.com that this was perhaps the angriest book you have ever written. You've been writing about education for many decades. Is the anger, does that stem from the fact that things seem to just be getting worse?
Not solely, though that's part of it. I mean, we're dealing with profoundly resegregated schools, but also grossly unequal schools. And since I'm close to the kids I write about, especially kids in California, with whom I've spent a lot of time in Los Angeles, and kids in the South Bronx, I don't see this as a question of numbers. I see it as real children that I know, little kids I know, in the South Bronx in New York City, which is still the poorest congressional district in America, get about $11,000 a year for their public education. If you lift them up and plunk them down in a really wealthy suburb of New York like Manhasset, which is, for those elsewhere in the nation, is sort of a classic super-rich white suburb where probably a lot of my Harvard classmates live. If you took one of these little kids who's now getting $11,000 a year in the South Bronx for her education, and you plunked her down in Manhasset, she'd be getting $22,000 a year. So if you know these children, you can't help but be angry. I'm too old at the age of 69 to bite my tongue. I don't try to soften my words in order to appease the people in the media who orchestrate acceptable opinion. Typically, the mainstream press, even the allegedly liberal press, praises my books, but says that I'm too impatient, that I'm not stating this with enough understatement and civility. And civility has come to be a code word for a kind of suffocating, stifling of your real feelings. But I'm too old to play that game. I don't care, you know, what price the white press makes me pay. I'm going to say what I believe now for the rest of my life. I'm not going to pull my punches on this issue because this is an atrocity. I mean, I go into these schools and I look around the room and I see, you know, I visit high schools that have 4,000 or 5,000 kids, and at most maybe three or four white kids in the whole building. And I try to tell myself that, you know, this is what Dr. King and Rosa Parks lived and died for. It's not just that we've ripped apart the legacy for which they lived, ripped apart the legacy of Brown, but that our media, with a few notable exceptions, absolutely refuse to name this reality. They will do anything they can to steer around this truth, especially when they're speaking about schools in their own community. Typically, even the best newspapers, like the New York Times, will deplore segregation as a national phenomenon. They're always in favor of integration, except when it comes to New York. And then when they speak of their own hometown, they suddenly dodge the issue altogether, and they come up with these sweeteners, such as when the New York Times describes a school that has 50% black kids, 45% Latino kids, and maybe 5% kids from Pakistan or Southeast Asia. They won't say this is a segregated school. Instead, they say, this is a school with many minorities, but a diverse population. And there's nothing diverse about it at all. Diverse has come to be a synonym for segregated. And to me, the shame of the nation is not simply that we've reverted to the old order of Plessy versus Ferguson, separate but equal decision of 1896, that actually haven't even lived up to Plessy because our schools are segregated, but they're not anywhere near equal. But the real shame of the nation is that the responsible, influential media, those who orchestrate acceptable opinion, refuse to name this reality and lack the guts to confront it. There are a few newspapers which should be named as notable exceptions. Newsday, which is a newspaper on Long Island outside New York, has been excellent and honest about this. And so too the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, which has been heroic on this subject, but very few other newspapers in America.
Jonathan Kozol, your books sell well. Shame of the Nation is selling well now, Amazing Grace, Savage Inequalities, and yet you just named a small handful of newspapers that you say are doing a good job. Why is it you think that the arguments that you make in these books about education, besides very sporadically, don't make it into the ongoing national debate about education?
Well, that's not entirely true. What I've discovered is that this new book, for example, The Shame of the Nation, is having a dynamic impact upon those who actually work in the front lines of our public schools. When I visited 25 cities this fall to talk about the book, I had the largest audiences I've ever seen since 1968, which was the high point of the civil rights movement, typically in cities like Chicago and Los Angeles and Seattle and New York City. Crowds of 1,500 people will turn out, and two-thirds of them are teachers. And they respond to this with indignation. In fact, I always pass around a sign-up sheet for people in the audience who don't want to simply, you know, sit there and have a one-time evening of moral indignation, but want to do something about it. And if there are 1,500 people in the audience, typically 500, 600, 700 sign up, and they add comments like, when do we start? When do we start mobilizing to change this? There's tremendous response among teachers, and that's why the book has become a bestseller, and also among really decent, thoughtful academic people. So, you know, thank God the kind of censorship that I've undergone from the major media like the New York Times and a few other papers that have that influence isn't able to cut me off from my real audience. Still, it's damaging. It's frustrating. The New York Times assigned my book for review to a man named Nathan Glazer, who is a warhorse of the neoconservative movement, who's been damning people who protest vocally for his entire career. So that's not even assigning a review. That's assigning a damnation in advance. The Wall Street Journal did the same thing with another right-wing critic. I'm used to this, and I can take it, but we're fighting a real powerful enemy here, not so much in the right-wing media. That doesn't surprise me. But in the allegedly centrist or liberal media, there's a kind of awful game being played right now, which is, yes, we honor Dr. King on his birthday every year, And yes, we, you know, write nostalgic stories on the anniversary of the Brown decision. And yes, we love to do feature stories on some upbeat ghetto school that's temporarily doing a little better than the rest. But otherwise, we refuse to confront the fact that we are reverting to an apartheid schooling system. We never use words like that. And when people like me use such words, we get gently rapped on the knuckles because such language might actually provoke people to do something about it.
Jonathan, I wanted to ask you about a review that appeared in Columbia Journalism Review. Linda Perlstein, who wrote the review, suggested that there were two problems with how the press covers public schools, particularly poor schools. One was a question of access. Administrators, principals are loath to open their doors to reporters for reasons that I think are arguably understandable. But at the same time, she faced personally editors who were hostile to the idea of even bringing up some of these issues. She recalled that when she was an education reporter at the Washington Post, again, a paper that enjoys a somewhat liberal reputation among some, she pitched a story about the resegregation of schools for a package they were doing on the anniversary of Brown versus Board of Education. And the editors deemed that just an inappropriate subject for the time. I imagine that doesn't surprise you all that much.
No, I'm not surprised at all. One national TV network producer who was talking to me recently for one of the most influential shows, I can't name the person, said, I talked with my bosses and they're a little scared of you. Very interesting. I'm not an outrageous person. My book is carefully documented. I put all the documentation in the back of my books because the book is a narrative and I want to tell a story. I've heard this in many ways. People, whether it's editors or sometimes the writers themselves, they're very reluctant to touch this. And what some newspapers do is they'll find a conservative black journalist to sort of sweeten the story by saying, no, we don't need to talk about things like apartheid, total racial isolation. We don't even need to talk about gross inequality in funding. Instead, let's concentrate on a couple of boutique schools in a particular city, which because of unusual circumstances, usually because of a charismatic principal or something like that, suddenly was able to pump the test scores a few percentage points. And so they do little success stories, and then they say, all we need to do is replicate this on a larger scale and the problem will be solved. And, you know, essentially they're saying, so we can have happy segregation. And what they tend to do also is if there's a sudden blip in the scores, if, you know, the fourth grade scores go up a couple percentage points in New York or some other city, they'll make big front page story out of this. Test scores up for minority kids. And again, the message seems to be, if you'll just follow the initiatives of President Bush and test these kids relentlessly, which is basically what the Bush agenda is about, and test these kids and drill them all year for their tests and hire private companies like Kaplan and Princeton Review to prep them for the test, that'll solve the problem. And then what we always find is that a couple years later, in an obscure story, it will say test scores down. These are always false gains. These are what I call testing gains, not learning gains. And the way I know this is because I meet the same fourth graders 4 years later when they're in eighth grade, and usually they can't write a cogent sentence or read a simple textbook. Indeed, by the time black and Latino kids get to 12th grade, if they get that far, because there's a colossal dropout rate, their average reading scores are about the same as those of white seventh graders. So all these are false promises, and the newspapers recycle these false promises again and again and again in order to avoid the main truth. And the main truth, which they dodge by a very convenient defect of vision, the main truth is that segregated schooling is the longest-lasting failed experiment in U.S. social history. We've had 110 years since Plessy versus Ferguson, and segregated schools have never been equal to the schools that serve the mainstream of America. They never were in the century just past. They never will be in the century ahead. And that's why my book speaks directly to activist teachers, idealistic teachers. There are tens of thousands of marvelous young teachers in these systems, and very angry older teachers, too. And also speaks to young people who are still in college and graduate school, and doesn't just appeal to them to care about this, because care is a favorite word of inert liberals. I'm not criticizing liberals. I'm a liberal, but, I mean, there's a kind of weary type of semi-liberal who loves to say, well, at least the least that we can do is care. And this always infuriates me, because what they really mean is the most that we intend to do is care. And I tell people in my book and at these mass rallies I've been holding, caring isn't enough. If you're going to honor people like Dr. King and Bob Moses, who for our younger listeners was one of the great heroes of the early civil rights movement, if you're going to honor the martyrs of the civil rights movement like Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman, who were murdered in Mississippi by the Ku Klux Klan, if you're going to honor Rosa Parks, don't just do it by reading sappy stories about them to your kids in fourth grade. Tell your kids the way to honor these people is by emulating their courage. And that means having the nerve to go out and march and protest and sit in and do whatever it takes, no matter how disruptive, as long as it's peaceful. To force this issue on the national agenda and to compel our political leaders to look this issue right in the face and to ask them the question bluntly, are you willing to live in an apartheid society in which the game is rigged from the starting gate against the poor? Or are you going to live up to the principles this nation says it stands for?
Jonathan Kozol, looking at federal education policy, No Child Left Behind enjoys praise or support from a pretty broad media constituency. Even liberal commentators who tend to disagree with the Bush White House on every other issue are fine with their education policy. You write in Shame of the Nation that the media are often plenty eager to tout the latest uptick in standardized test scores. You've touched on that already here, particularly when they show a narrowing between white and non-white students, the much-discussed achievement gap. Why do these stories land on the front page while these other issues that you explore in such detail go begging for media interest?
Well, one reason is that the press, even at its most sincere, and I'm not attributing invidious motives to education writers, they are always told to look for signs of progress. You know, sort of a typical story is a flame of hope within the ashes. And so, you know, typically anything that can be inflated into the illusion of success within the box of segregation gets lots of attention. The fact of the matter is that the president's testing bill is officially known as NCLB, No Child Left Behind, though teachers call it No Child Left Untested, is based on the delusion that if you just make life hell for kids by testing them obsessively, that this will be a nice substitute for equal opportunity. It ain't. And I'm telling you, I don't know what distant ivory tower liberals are saying about this, because I simply don't read boring think tank reports. They're no fun to read. But I know what teachers think. Teachers tell me, number one, this obsessive testing is of absolutely no use to teachers because the results almost never come back until the following summer. So the president says something to the effect that all we're trying to do is help Miss O'Brien learn where little Susie's weaknesses lie so she can help little Susie. But, you know, I don't know what planet the president's on, but these test results never come back in time. By the time they come back, the child's in the next grade. Secondly, it's forcing teachers to teach obsessively and exclusively to the tests. And I describe in my book just horrendous situations where, you know, in one case, a marvelous young teacher, wonderful, wonderful, altruistic young teacher who was steeped in civil rights traditions, the kind of teacher I'm always recruiting to go into the inner city schools, was teaching fifth grade in the South Bronx, and she had to spend virtually a quarter of the year doing nothing except drilling kids for exams. So what this does is it's driving out the best teachers, because really wonderful teachers who got good education in good suburban schools and know what education is refuse to accept this role of being like drill sergeants for the state. And a lot of these schools are inundated with business and corporate language and vocabulary. The teachers in some of these schools are told to put up signs where they call the most successful children in the class best workers. They use the term workers. Sometimes they put up signs assigning every child to be a manager of some sort. I was in one totally segregated school where second graders had jobs like blackboard cleaner manager, waste paper basket manager, line manager. I couldn't dream what line manager meant. It sounded like a Ford factory, but it turned out that meant manager of lining kids up, instead of just saying that that was her little job. And they even had earnings charts for writing good sentences. So really wonderful teachers who have any kind of, you know, deeply intellectual education, who've gone to top suburban schools, find this abhorrent, atrocious. They didn't come into education to be branch managers for global corporations. And so they quit. And they either end up in the top suburban schools or they give up entirely. And as their parents tend to pressure them to do, they go to business school or something like that. They figure, well, if I'm going to have to talk business language, I might as well go into business and earn real money. And good teachers, you know, a good teacher can't come into a class and write up on the blackboard, I read my kids a wonderful poem of Langston Hughes or Gwendolyn Brooks, and they loved it. No, because love has nothing to do with it, because that's not going to show up on the tests that have to be given. Instead, she has to say something like, I used a poem of Langston Hughes to deliver the following three skills that are going to be measured on state exams. It's just to write exactly what they are on the blackboard. A lot of these schools have abolished recess, so they'll have more time drilling kids for exams. And one district, they abolished nap time from kindergarten. Kindergarten kids were taking high-stakes tests. This has been a nightmare. And President Bush, you know, whatever his intent, I'm sure he doesn't understand any of this. Sure, he takes his advice from others. But essentially, you know, he's turning teachers into accountants. And he's making the school day miserable for children. And he's taking away any sense that the purpose of learning is to enjoy the culture, that the purpose of reading is to enjoy a book. Instead, everything has to have an immediate utilitarian payoff, an earnings chart. Always in these schools, there's a lot of emphasis on training these kids to be useful workers in the American economy, but always at the lowest possible level. I'm in schools in which Black and Latino girls are channeled away from academic courses, these are high schools, into vocational programs like hairdressing and sewing, even when they ask to take academic classes. So we don't just have an apartheid school system now, we have an apartheid curriculum. And no child left behind should not just be doctored and toyed with and beautified a little bit. It ought to be abolished. It ought to be reversed, and all the money that's being wasted on this sociopathic agenda of turning little kids into examination soldiers ought to be used instead for something that will actually help them learn. If I were education secretary, I would take every dollar that's now being squandered on absolutely useless testing and measurement of little children, and I would transfer all that money into a program of universal pre-K, for 3 years of wonderful pre-K, that means preschool education for every poor child in America. And where we don't have that in the typical inner city schools, virtually less than a quarter of the kids get even half a day of preschool. It's outrageous. I mean, there's an old expression I've always loved. You don't fatten your lambs by weighing them. But all we're doing now is weighing these lambs, and that's how I think of these little kids, because they're so innocent and vulnerable and sweet kids. They're nice kids. We're weighing them, but meanwhile, we're starving them of what they need in order to prevail.
Now, finally, Jonathan, you write and you speak about big city newspapers that virtually ignore and literally ignore the schools in their own backyards. And you can sort of imagine what a newspaper editor might say to you, that these are problems that are intractable and unsolvable. You're talking about poverty and racism. I'm the editor of one metropolitan newspaper, or I produce one television newscast every night, what possible effect could I have on changing these literally unsolvable problems? What would your response be to them?
My response would be, why the hell does a newspaper exist? And unless it's going to be faithful to that famous slogan, to afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted. You know, our major newspapers do a lot of very aggressive and clearly advocacy-type writing in order to, for example, create a huge market for the new fashions every year. In New York, good God, the New York Times sometimes sounds as if it's in the business of, you know, selling clothes, the spring collection. And if they didn't write these stories, clothing companies would not sell as many clothes as they do and then wouldn't be able to take those full-page ads in the New York Times every Sunday. So obviously newspapers believe, editors know, that they can influence the preferences of their readers. This is a decision not to enter an area that might antagonize some of their most privileged readers.
We've been speaking with Jonathan Kozol, author of Shame of the Nation, The Restoration of Apartheid Schooling in America. Jonathan Kozol, thanks again for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thanks a lot.